Well, we're in Genesis 28 tonight. And I'm afraid I've scared some people off. I threatened to preach till 8 o'clock tonight, and there's a Saints game tonight, so they decided they'd just skip church, not have to listen to me preach, and not take the chance on missing it, I guess. We had studied a few weeks ago about Isaac and his bride, Rebekah, and if you remember back to that, how that occurred, that Abraham didn't want his son Isaac to marry one of the women who was from the Canaanites that lived around them. And so he sent one of his trusted servants to go choose a wife from his people and bring her back to marry Isaac. Well, Isaac and Rebekah's plan for their son is a little different than Abraham and Sarah's plan. They still feel the same way. If you remember, we talked about a couple of weeks ago that Esau had married some of the daughters of the Hittites or of Heth, and those were a disturbing thing for them. They couldn't stand that having happened. And so they didn't want Jacob to do the same thing. At least Rebekah made it very clear that she didn't want Jacob to take a wife of the daughters of Heth like the ones that Esau had taken. And so she told her husband that. She apparently had a good bit of influence with him, as many wives do with their husbands in these kinds of matters. And so Isaac then, in chapter 28, is going to call Jacob in. And he's going to give him some marriage advice of sorts. Although I guess in some ways it was a little more than advice. It was more of a command. Which seems odd to us in our society today because we think of Jacob and Esau as being grown men. Esau's already got two wives. So they're grown men and yet their parents are telling them what to do. We generally don't think of things that way. We think, well, when you know, somebody gets off and they get on out of the nest and they make their own decisions. In this society that these individuals lived in, the idea of honoring your parents continued on into adulthood, that you still listened to them, you were still guided by them, you many times still lived with them. And we noticed as Jacob was deceiving Isaac that Jacob and Esau both lived right there, where Isaac could call Esau in and send him out, and then Rebekah could call Jacob and say, hey, come on in here and let's get one of the kids. They were living as an extended family unit. So it was a different world than the one we live in now. It was much more like the way things used to be. You hear about those extended families where the grandparents and the parents and the children and the grandchildren, they all live there together. Whereas now, we're often scattered to the four corners of the United States and sometimes to foreign countries as well before we get to be 30 or 40 years old. The children have scattered all over, with the parents wondering, which one am I going to spend Christmas with this year, and which one am I going to go see for Thanksgiving, or is there any way I could get all of them to come here? And you know, we're a much different society than what they were, but we can understand how they worked, and we understand some of the things that happened. But Isaac didn't send a servant to go get a wife for Jacob. He didn't exert that extent of control like his father had. But instead, he calls Jacob to him, and he blessed him again. I was discussing that situation with Isaac and Jacob tricking him with my parents, and my mother was very quick to say, well, if he'd have done that to me, I'd have taken that blessing back, and he'd have been cut out of the will. But Jacob got away with it. He did that deceptive thing, and he got away with it. I think that's part of what the New Testament talks about when it says, at the times of this ignorance, God winked. There was a time when God let some things happen that he didn't really approve of, but he let them go. He let it happen because it served in the long run for his purpose. We talked in Bible class this morning in the book of Proverbs about the fact that God can use even the wicked. He can use sinful things that people do and turn it for good. And we talked about the crucifixion of Christ and how Judas betrayed Christ and Pilate authorized his execution and those things. Well, here Jacob deceived his father in order to get the blessing. But really, if we look back, if we remember, that was the prophecy. When Rebekah was having those twins and struggling with them in her womb, and she went to find out and asked the Lord, "What's wrong with me? Why is it this way?" And the Lord explained to her that there were two nations in her womb. And He said, "The older shall serve the younger." The younger was going to be the one that got the blessing. It was going to be the one that got the birthright. It was going to be the one that got all of the advantages. And that was Jacob. And so God knew ahead of time how this was going to play out. Doesn't mean that He caused it. Doesn't mean that He made Jacob do anything wrong. But He knew. God's foreknowledge is always there throughout the Bible. He always knows ahead of time what's going to happen. That's one of the reasons that Satan never can get the advantage over God. As hard as Satan tries, and he tries hard to defeat everything that God is working toward, he never can be fully successful in that because God knows what the future holds. And the devil, even though he's beyond human understanding, beyond us, he's been around since the beginning of time back there in the Garden of Eden, he was there, and he's had lots of experience, and he gets the better of us a lot of times, but he can't get the better of God because he doesn't know the future. He doesn't know what people will and won't do. He can try, and he can tempt them, and he can do all those things, but he can't know how things are going to play out when God can. And so, Jacob gets this blessing from his father, and at the same time, he charged him. Some translations translate that he commanded him. Now, of course, any commandment can be disobeyed. But it wasn't just a piece of advice. It wasn't just fatherly advice or a friendly advice. He was telling his son, "This is what you're supposed to do. This is a command for you." And here's what he said to him. He said, "You shall not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan." Esau had already done that. They didn't stop Esau from doing it. They didn't warn Esau not to do it. They didn't tell him not to do it. Maybe, and this seems to happen a lot of times in the church, that from one generation to the next, we fail to pass on sometimes the things that our parents knew. And that's why it's very difficult to find a situation where there are more than three or four generations of faithful Christians, because each generation they pass down less and less, it seems like. And so often, you know, somebody may say, "Well, you know, my mom's and my grandma was," but then if you trace it back, you find, well, somebody back there was converted. And then if you follow other families, they were faithful, but then the children aren't, and the grandchildren or the grandchildren aren't. Somewhere down there, we lose that. We don't keep training and teaching from generation to generation to generation. One of the things that is making the Muslim movement so powerful, they don't lose their children very much. I mean, probably because they'll kill them if they convert from being Muslim to any other religion. That may be part of it. But you know, we've got to work on the young people and training them and teaching them these things. The problem that Isaac had was, even though his father knew, Abraham knew, he didn't want his son to have a wife from the Canaanites and went and got one for him. Isaac didn't really think that was that big a deal until after Esau married some of those Canaanite wives. And then it started to be a problem. And then they started to realize, this isn't really what we wanted for our son. And so they stopped Jacob from going down the same path that his older brother had gone down and not making the same mistakes. And so they sent him off. He says, "You go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father." That would be his grandfather. That's Rebekah's father, Bethuel. And he went, he was supposed to go there, and he says, "And take a wife of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother." So he was told, go marry your cousin. It was kind of the thing that we don't usually recommend for our children nowadays. But back then it was perfectly acceptable for cousins to marry. Isaac and Rebecca were cousins. And so for Jacob to marry a cousin was not out of order. It wasn't an unusual thing at this time. Then he goes on to explain in part of that blessing. He says, "And God bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you that you may be a multitude of people and give you the blessing of Abraham to you and to your seed with you that you may inherit the land wherein you are a stranger, which God gave unto Abraham." So here we have, Abraham had passed that blessing on to Isaac, and God had dealt with Isaac, not Ishmael, not any of Abraham's other sons. Isaac now passes that blessing, says, "Let the Lord give you the blessing He promised Abraham." Jacob's going to get it, not Esau. Part of it may have been because Esau had gone and married those Canaanite women. Part of it may have been because Esau had despised his birthright. Part of it may have been just the fact that Jacob tricked his way into getting that first blessing. And Isaac gives him the rest of the blessing. That Jacob's the one who's going to get to receive that promise. That his descendants, that he's going to get to have that land. His descendants are going to have the land that was promised to Abraham. And it gets passed on. And so Isaac sent him away to go to Laban, who was Rebekah's brother, and to find one of his daughters so that he wouldn't take a wife from the Canaanites. Now when Esau saw this, you know, there's always a little sibling rivalry going on. When Esau saw that his father and mother had told Jacob this and had blessed him and told him not to marry a daughter of the Canaanites, how do you suppose that made Esau feel to find out, "Well, I married daughters of the Canaanites and they don't like that"? He knew it didn't please them. And he saw that Jacob was obedient to them and didn't marry the daughters of Canaan, but he was going to go find somebody from his own people to marry. Well, Esau decides he's going to try to do something to make them a little happier. Or else he tries to spite them. I'm not sure. It can go either way. Because what he does is, he goes to Ishmael and takes one of Ishmael's daughters as his wife. Now, I don't know how Isaac felt about Ishmael by this time. They didn't get along real well when they were younger. But I wonder if Esau's thinking was, "Well, you know, this is one of Abraham's descendants also. This is my cousin. And maybe my father will be more pleased with me marrying somebody in the family. This isn't a Canaanite," in other words. "This is one of Abraham's descendants." And so, whatever his thinking was, unfortunately, it just didn't really help the situation any. He now has three wives, which we know, the Bible tells us that a man shouldn't marry two wives. You might not realize that, but when Jesus said no man can serve two masters, He made it very clear you can't marry two wives. But anyway, we do realize that during this time, there was not a law against a man marrying more than one wife. It wasn't something that God had planned. It wasn't something that He approved of necessarily, but He allowed it. We talked before about those. He allowed a lot of things that weren't really the plan. If you remember, Jesus said from the beginning, it was one man and one woman. That was the way it's supposed to be. That was the plan. But God had never told any of them, as far as we know up to this point, that they couldn't marry more than one wife. And so they often did if they had the resources to do so. And of course, it did help to multiply their offspring to have more than one wife. Had Jacob only married Rachel as he desired, then he would only have ever had two children, because Rachel only ever gave birth to two children. But because he had two wives and two concubines, he wound up with a house full. He had 13 children at least, 12 sons and the daughter, Dinah. But we see that it was one way that nations were built, by a man having more than one wife and more than one opportunity for descendants then as well. But certainly, Isaac only had the one wife. As far as we know, he was never unfaithful to her in any way. And yet, his sons both wind up with multiple marriages. Maybe they look back to their grandfather who had had the situation with Hagar as well as then, and then after their mother, after their grandmother had died, he had another wife as well. But maybe they decided we'll just have them all at once instead of trying to put it off till later. But Esau did that. He went and took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, as his wife. Well, then Jacob, as he's traveling along, it kind of goes a little forward to Esau going and getting that wife. Now we're going to come back to Jacob's left and he's traveling. Back to our main character. Meanwhile, over here, this is what's been happening. Jacob went from Beersheba, that's where they were staying, and he headed toward Haran, heading back up to the old homeland. And as he's heading along, he found a place, and he stayed there all night because it was nighttime. He just camped out. There wasn't anybody about. He took the stones of that place and put them for his pillows, and he laid down to sleep. You know, we have that song that says, "And sometimes like the prophet, my pillow a stone." Well, Jacob used a stone for a pillow, literally. I have enough trouble with a nice soft pillow sometimes. I can't imagine using a rock. Doesn't seem real comfortable, but he slept with that pillow. And he had a dream. Now remember, with Abraham, God would speak to him. He would come down in the form of a man and talk with Abraham. The Lord would just come and talk with him. Now he did have visions as well. But it's rare in the Bible, anywhere in the Bible, outside of course Jesus when he was walking on the earth, it's rare for there to be someone that God spoke to face to face like he did Abraham. About the only other person that he did that with was Moses. But they were two very special individuals. He didn't speak to everybody that way. Most of the time with the prophets, they never saw God. He never spoke to them personally. It was through a vision. They'd have a vision and see God. It'd be something like Samuel, where it was in the middle of the night and they'd hear the voice, but they'd never see God face to face the way Abraham did. Well, Jacob, he doesn't see God face to face here as such. He's having a dream. He's having a vision. And God would often communicate through these visions. And the vision that he has is he saw a ladder with the bottom of it on the earth and the top of it reaching to heaven. We call that Jacob's ladder, although I'm pretty sure it wasn't his. It must have been God's ladder, because that's a pretty big ladder. To go from earth all the way to heaven. And as he watched it there, he noticed that the angels were going up and down this ladder, doing God's will, no doubt. God would send one to go do something, and off he'd go. And then he'd come back, and another one would be sent somewhere else. Now, of course, again, remember, this is a dream. There's not a place on earth where there's a ladder set up that angels go up and down. This is a vision. This is the way God is showing Jacob how he works, how he sends his angels, his servants, to go and help and do what he wants them to go and do. And so he sees this vision, and as he's there looking at it, the Lord was up at the top of the ladder. Up there, as he looked up at the top of the ladder, there was the Lord. And as he sees the Lord up there, the Lord spoke to him in this dream and in this vision. He said, "I'm the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereon you lie, I will give to you and to your seed." Now remember, at this time, he's still in what we call Canaan land. He's still in that land. He hasn't left that area yet. He's traveled north from Beersheba. If you remember back when we looked at that map, Beersheba is at the very south edge of Judah. And he's traveling north. He's going up to the northern way to get back to Haran, which is over on the east side of the Jordan River. And so, he also says that he's making this promise. Now remember, Isaac, in the blessing he gave Jacob, it said, and let the Lord give you the blessing, the promise that he promised Abraham. And so here the Lord does just that. And he says down in verse 14, your seed will be as the dust of the earth. You'll spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. You remember that promise? That was the promise that was made to Abraham back when. Your descendants, your seed, is going to bless all the nations of the earth. Now, in the New Testament, when the Apostle Paul is writing in Galatians and looking back on these circumstances, he says that seed is Christ. It's not that Jacob is going to bless the whole world, or even his children, or that the Jews as a whole. Because Paul makes it very clear that he says, and to seed as one, not seeds as many. Not many seeds, but one seed. And he said, that seed is Christ. Jesus Christ. That's the one that came and blessed all the nations of the world. And so here we have this promise, though the understanding of it, well, they don't understand what that fulfillment's going to be. Still some 1,500 years into the future or more. They're not understanding all of the implications of this. All they know is the Lord's blessing them. The Lord's going to be with them, he says, in verse number 15, I am with you, I will keep you everywhere you go, and will bring you again into this land, for I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken to you. And so Jacob woke up from his dream and from his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I didn't know. And so he was afraid. And he said, how dreadful is this place. This is none other than the house of God and the gate to heaven. That'd be quite a shocking event. As far as we know, before this time, Jacob had never had any interaction with God. He'd never had a vision like this, a dream like this. This was a disturbing circumstance for him the first time. I mean, most of us, you know, we think about, what would you do? I mean, we're used to having dreams. And I'm sure Jacob had dreams of the regular sort. But this was an unusual dream. What would we do if we heard the voice of God? I know I hear people talk about, well, God spoke to me and told me, no, I don't think so. Because when God speaks to you, you'd feel like Jacob did here. He woke up and he was afraid, and it was a frightening experience. People talk about God spoke to him like they talk about somebody called him on the phone. When God speaks, it is a momentous occasion, and it changes people's lives forever after. It's not just the kind of casual conversation that we have with each other. It's not the same thing. And people need to realize that. But he says, this is the house of God that I'm in. And in fact, as he got up early that next morning, he took that stone that had been his pillow and he set it up as a pillar, a monument of sorts. Now, it wasn't a very big monument, I don't imagine, being it was just his pillow. It probably couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 feet. But he stood that thing up there, and then he poured some oil on top of it, and he called the name of the place Bethel, which means house of God. House of God, that's what he called it. In fact, any of the Beth somethings in the Bible, Bethany, Bethsaida, if it starts with Beth, it's house of something. Bethlehem, they're all of those, that Beth means house of. And so in this case, it's the house of El. Elohim was God's name. Sometimes it was just shortened to El. Now we often hear about Jehovah or Yahweh, and some people pronounce it either way. Elohim was the first name by which God was known. Elohim meant Almighty, the Lord God Almighty, Elohim. And so here's God, the Almighty, and this is His house, Jacob says. And he sets up the monument to remind him, if he ever comes back that way, of where God's house is. Now, we know. God doesn't have a house here on earth. Even when he had them build the tabernacle, even when he had Solomon build the temple, he didn't have a house here on earth. He didn't live there. He came and visited. His presence would come into the place at times, and when they offered sacrifices and things. And today, as the church, we talk about the church is the temple of God. It's not a physical thing. God doesn't live in the church building in that sense. And physically, no, it's not like that. But that's Jacob's perception. That's where he had seen God, and so that's where this is where God is. He had a limited understanding. A lot of the people at this time, like some of the people today, don't realize that God's everywhere and God sees everything. But the psalmist said it, the heaven of heavens cannot contain you. He's so big, he's so mighty, he is omnipresent, he's everywhere that he wants to be. He doesn't just live in one little spot. And so, even though Jacob calls it the house of God, we know it wasn't really God's house, but that was Jacob's perception of things. This is where he met God for the first time. And so he sets that up, and the place used to be called Luz. Now, if you remember back, we talked about during Abraham's time, in some of Abraham's journeys, it said that he went up to Bethel. And at that time I said, now it wasn't called Bethel yet. Because here's where it's called Bethel. This is where Jacob names the place Bethel. But by the time Moses writes about all these things, they knew it as Bethel. But he mentions here that before that it was called Luz. So this area already had a name, but Jacob gave it his name. Now that's a common thing. Happened a lot here in this country. Now, the Indians had names for a lot of things. And when the white man came, the Europeans came and settled different areas, sometimes they continued to call it by the Indian name. But sometimes they gave it their own name. And so I'm pretty sure that, Pennsylvania was not what the Indians called that area. Virginia was not what the Indians called that area. Now, Mississippi, that's what the Indians called it. So some of the things, we got the Indian name for those things, and some things, the Europeans renamed them. Well, here, Jacob renamed something. He wants it to have his name because a special event to him took place there. But he makes a vow now. Remember I said that when you have an encounter with God, it's going to be a life-changing experience for you. Everything from that point on is going to be different in your life. And Jacob's life changes at this point. He becomes almost a different person. I mean, he's still Jacob, but he's just different. He vows a vow. He says, if God will be with me, that's what the promise God has made, I'm going to be with you. And he says, if that's the case, if that happens and keeps me in the way that I go and gives me bread to eat and clothes to wear so that I can come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. So he kind of said, okay, God, you promised me you're going to do all these things. If you do what you're promised, then you're going to be my God. Now notice, he didn't say, you're the God of my grandfather and the God of my father. But then now he says, if you do what you said you're going to do, you're going to be my God. In every situation, in every generation, every individual has to come to the point where the God they serve, it's not mama's God or daddy's God, it's not my grandparents' God, it's my God. I can't, if I'm just serving God because He was Grandma's God, I'm not going to serve Him. Not well. Oh, I may go to church where Grandma went to church. And I may even go all the time. But if He's not my God, then I'm not really going to serve Him. I'm just only going to serve Him as far as I think it'll make Grandma happy. But when He becomes my God, then I'm going to serve Him 100%. And it's a difficult thing for young people, especially who have grown up in a particular religious group, whether it's in the church or whether it's in a denomination, and they've grown up going to church there and hearing the things that are taught there and knowing Mama or Daddy or both go there and teach them those things. But then at some point in their life, for some of them it's in their early teenage years, for some of them it's when they go off to college, for some of them it's when they get married, for some of them it never happens in their whole life, but at some point they need to come to the conclusion that the Lord is my God. Their parents' faith is not good enough. They have to have their own faith. They have to believe in God because they believe in God, not because Mama and Daddy did. And that's a difficult thing because sometimes that means that some children challenge what their parents believed. Some children don't believe what their parents believe because they don't get the same faith their parents had. Maybe because their parents didn't have the right faith and they learned the truth. And so they grasped hold of God as their God truly where their parents hadn't. Sometimes even though their parents may have grasped hold of God truly and had a deep faith and a true faith, somehow those kids get swept away by society and by their friends and companions and peer pressure and whatever else and don't keep having the kind of faith that their parents had in God. But we've got to work on that. We have to constantly do everything we can, not just to tell the children what to believe, but to teach them how to grow in their own faith in God. Because as parents and grandparents or aunts or uncles or even as other adults in the church, our faith is not going to be good enough when they're out there facing temptation on their own. They've got to have their own faith. They've got to stand on their own two feet against those temptations. They can't depend on somebody else's faith. And Jacob's getting to that point now. Now, he's a grown man already. Now, he hadn't gotten married yet, but he's getting there. He's fixing to go find him a wife. And he needs to know, who's his God going to be? Who's he going to serve? Who's he going to worship? The indication seems to be that Esau never served the Lord. That he went off and you don't hear anything else about Esau or any of his descendants serving the Lord and obeying God. But Jacob does because he had this encounter with God and it changed him. He says, "This stone which I've set up for a pillar will be God's house. And all that you shall give me, I will surely give a tenth to you." Now, I'm not sure exactly how he was going to give that tenth, since there wasn't a priesthood set up at this time or anything. But Jacob promised God, whatever you give me, whatever you bless me with, I'm going to give you back 10% of it. And this is where this and the case with Melchizedek and Abraham that we've looked at before is where people get that idea of that tenth, that tithe, that 10%. That's where they get the idea for it. It began even before the law of Moses. In the law of Moses, it became the law. But these are the places that it began back before that. Of course, I hope that all of us understand, even though, of course, Jacob was only talking about a tenth of the things of his possessions, but I hope we don't think we can give God just a tenth of ourselves. He's never pleased with that. He wants all of us. He wants our all. He wants everything that we are to be His. To serve Him, to worship Him, to love Him with all of our heart, soul, strength, and mind, Jesus said. That's the first commandment. That's the greatest commandment. And we need to do that. If you're here tonight and you've not been giving God everything, maybe you've just been giving Him a portion. Maybe you've just been giving Him 10%. Well, you know, I went to church on Sunday. That's enough. God got His share. No, that's not enough for God. Now, I know we're not going to sit in church all week. But this is just kind of like the pep rally to get us pumped up and ready to go out there and live for the Lord and serve Him all week long. out there is where we face the real trials and troubles and temptations. I hope that all of us, I know we're not going to have a dream or a vision like Jacob did, and I know we're not going to hear the voice of God, or He's not going to come speak to us face to face like He did with Abraham. But when we come to Him in His Word and study what He wants us to do, we should come to realize what He wants of us and have the kind of encounter with Him through the Bible that changes our lives. That we're not the same after we've studied His Word as we were before. I hope that all of us will grow and gain a deeper and stronger faith in the Lord as our God. Not our father's God, or mother's God, or grandpa's God, or something like that. He needs to be our God. That's the only kind of faith that will really withstand the storms of life and the temptations that Satan puts before us. If you hear and need to respond to the invitation tonight, please do so, and as we stand and as we sing.